me just a moment. I didn't come up here. Earl, is the microphone on? Am I loud enough?
No, you're not loud enough.
I'm not. Hold on just a moment. We'll get our act together. We're good? Okay. Thank you very much. It is a privilege to be here today. Now, I have to warn you, I grew up Baptist, and we specialize in one-hour sermons. But I was told this morning that there's a Bears game on at 12 o'clock, so I cut it down a little bit. I would like to start out with a story. It's a story of a guy I knew in college when I was at college, we had all the freshmen in the same dorm. And of course, in that dorm, there was always a resident assistant. I assume that North Park operates in a similar manner. And the resident assistant had a roommate named Vern. And Vern was a really, really interesting guy. Vern was extremely smart. I remember going into his room as a freshman. Now, he was a junior at that time. I remember going into his room, and on his bookshelves, he had the complete works of Luther, and he had read them. This guy was just absolutely amazing. After college, I ran into Vern again when I was working at a mission on Skid Row called the Olive Branch Mission. And Vern was part of a community that was part of the Olive Branch. And this would have been in the late 70s, early 80s, when it was like kind of cool to be in community, sort of like everybody was doing Jesus People stuff. And so they had this community, and he was one of the leaders of that community that was sort of vaguely affiliated with the homeless mission. And he was a guy who was really dedicated to issues of justice. He was really smart and knew his theology very, very well. 10 years later, I had lost track of Vern and his wife. 10 years later, there's some event, and I see Vern's wife, and I say, "Hi, how are you?" She says, "I'm doing okay. How is Vern?" And then she gets a look on her face. "You know, Vern and I aren't married anymore." I said, "Oh, that's so sad. What happened?" "I don't know. One day he just announced that he was leaving, and he also announced that he didn't believe in God anymore, and he ran off with this younger woman, and I haven't seen him since." Wow. I was shocked. I was shocked. What was going on there? And you know, I don't really know. I can't crawl inside of someone's head and know what was going on with Vern. But there was this incredible disconnect between this guy who knew it and actually not just knew it, but was involved in issues of justice and compassion and creating community. And there was this disconnect between that part of him and something else that was going on in his heart. And so I'm going to get back to Vern and some thoughts about Vern after we come and visit Moses giving the Ten Commandments yet again to the people of Israel. I want to spend some time talking about today's text. It is perhaps the best known text of the Old Testament. If you ask someone, "Tell me something about the Old Testament," you might get Adam and Eve, but you are just as likely to get the Ten Commandments. After all, if they have not read the book, they at least saw the movie. We hear about the Ten Commandments perhaps more than any other part of the Old Testament. In fact, the Ten Commandments are listed twice. First, in the book of Exodus, which, if you saw the movie, marks the end of the journey out of Egypt and the beginning of the 40 years in the wilderness. And secondly, we have it here in our text today in the book of Deuteronomy, where it begins a section about God's law and people's behavior, just as the Hebrews are about to enter the promised land. They're about to cross over the River Jordan into that place that they had been waiting for a generation. The 40 years in the wilderness are ended. And those 40 years were bookmarked by the two recitations of the Ten Commandments. We all have some prejudices and thoughts about the Ten Commandments. For some of us, it is a moral code by which we ought to live our lives. Yet for others, it is proof that God is only about rules, and rules that are impossible to follow. And yet, even for others, it is a political manifesto, part of an effort to make America great again. But for Moses and the Hebrews, it had a special purpose. For the children of Israel were about to enter into their new homeland, and some basic issues needed to be resolved before they did that. And the most basic issue that needed to resolve was the creation of a community. For you see, the Hebrews were not yet a community. They were a group of people who wandered out of Egypt, and yet they were a conglomeration of tribes. And not only were they a conglomeration of tribes, but they picked up a bunch of people along the way. They were a group of people that were bound by a common heritage of slavery. But upon being released from slavery, they did not have the same kind of tribal identity that normally would be necessary for the creation of a nation. They did not have a common geography, which people used to identify who we are as a people. They didn't have a land that they had lived in for generations that said, "This is us, we are the people of this land. These are our boundaries." What they did have, though perhaps at this point only very vaguely, was a sense of having a common God. If bondage unified them, then once liberated, what would unite them? They did share a common language, and they did share, perhaps vaguely, this common religion, but they did not have that sense of tribal identity. The book of Deuteronomy literally is the second law, or the second giving of the law. It's really a book about the creation of a covenant that God is making with a people that he has chosen. After recounting the history of these people, Moses opens the section that is starting in chapter 4 about God's law with the statement that the statutes and the rules are for the creation of a new nation in a new land. And as a result of following these statutes and rules, the people would become wise and just, and the wisdom and justice of God's people would become a witness to the surrounding nations of God's goodness and righteousness. But these rules need to be understood not as a giving of a personal moral code to each individual, but should be understood as creating the rules that would shape a community. It is a community that is not based on a common ethnic heritage or political ideology. It is not based on a sense of tribal identity or a sense of geographic identity, but it is a community created bound by the covenant relationship with God. And the task of building this community resides in the willingness and the discipline to follow and practice certain activities that will reinforce this covenant and strengthen the mutual bonds between the people of an emerging nation. At the heart, then, of this covenant is the right understanding and the right relationship with God. For the Hebrews, the shared identity that they were claiming was not an identity that simply arose from human circumstances. That is, an identity that depended upon a specific deity. It was rather an identity that depended upon a specific deity that was actively involved in their lives and called them into existence out of a hostile country into a land that was still to be discovered. The new community was not tribal, it was trans-tribal. That is, the tribal identity was always going to be secondary to the unity of the community under God. Thus, repeated the concern throughout the Old Testament of the concern for the stranger, the sojourner, the one who is not a part of the tribal family, but the one who is nonetheless a part of the community. And I think this bears repeating. The community that was being created was bigger than any kind of a tribe or common identity. It was bigger than any kind of homogeneous unit that naturally arises in the course of human life and activity. And the reminder that the stranger, by the way, stranger means the person who's not part of our tribe, right? The stranger, the sojourner, the person who doesn't look like us, who doesn't have the same accent that we have, the person who was not born in our community but nonetheless lives there, that this person is a part of this covenantal relationship and is thus a part of the community, even if they are not part of the tribe that you belong to. And so we come to the commandments. The first commandment that Moses gives to the people from God is, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. This commandment starts with this shared identity. The God who is creating your community is the same God that brought you out of slavery. The second part of the commandment reinforces the unique and exclusive relationship. God is not one of many deities. He's not the one that's supposed to be the first on the list while you accumulate other deities behind him. No, this guy claims that he is a jealous God. He's jealous because he doesn't want anything else to be added to his relationship with his people. It is God alone who commands all of our attention and loyalty. The next commandment repeats and reinforces the first. God is not just the first among a company of deities. There can be no other pagan gods included in the worship of the one true God. To take the Lord's name in vain is to disregard the nature and majesty of the one true God. Speaking of God is not to be undertaken lightly or in an unserious manner. It also means just as God upholds his promise, so also the promise that we make to God are expected to be fulfilled and not abandoned. We don't make promises to God lightly. We don't make promises to God lightly. That is the ultimate meaning of vain. It is something that is said but not followed through. The first three commandments speak to the creation of a new community defined not by tribe or geography, but defined by their relationship to the Creator and Redeemer God. However, In the creation of a community based on identity with God, the second issue arises, and that is, how is community to be maintained? I would say that the next group of commandments actually goes to our behavior and our relationship with each other. It is the moral code that allows a group of diverse people to share not just space, but life together. The Sabbath commandment is the most interesting because it bridges the first two groups. It speaks both to the need to set aside time to honor God, but it also speaks to the need for human rest. As such, it affects community behavior. It does not fit into our modern sense of morality, where today we value work highly. However, rest is important. And the rest commanded is not just rest for ourselves, but rest for those over whom we exercise control. It is rest for our children, it is rest for our employees, and even rest for our animals. It is a rest not just for the privileged, but it is a rest and a right to rest given to all, especially to those who have no power. And as we read these commandments, we must read them as rules for a community of which we are a part. It is and remains the foundation for creating a people, a community, which is apart from the rest of civilization. A community whose existence is based upon a calling of God to be a people of God. And yet, the rules are not enough. These rules were given at Mount Sinai to God's people. And as Moses recounts in the passage, he reminds them of the original giving of these rules at Mount Sinai, the commandments. And he reminds them of the incredible pledge of loyalty that they made. Yes, this is amazing. This is amazing. How can we not live our lives in obedience to this God? And yet we know the story. It didn't stick. The commandments did not hold, and that generation fell away. 40 years later, and to a new generation, Moses now repeats the law. While repeating the Ten Commandments, Moses then goes on in this next chapter, chapter 6, and he sums up the whole of the commandment with an important addition. It is love. What keeps us faithful is love. These same words that Moses spoke are repeated 1,500 years later by Jesus. The whole of the law can be summed up by this, that we love the Lord our God with all of our heart and mind, and that we love our neighbors as ourselves. The rules are not enough. We need the rules because they create a structure, an objective structure that we need to establish relationships and to know God. But without love at the heart of the relationship, we will never have the power to create a healthy community and overcome the issues that divide us. And this brings me back to Vern. I do not know his heart. I don't know really what was going on with him. But I can conjecture that what was missing was love. He had the head knowledge. The guy was brilliant. He knew his theology perfectly. He understood the concept of justice. He was a justice warrior, as so many young people are today. And yet something vital was missing. I have this wonderful quote from Thomas Merton that I would like to share with you. because I think it captures really the essence of what's going on. And Merton is talking about faith. And he starts out and says, faith, first of all, is not an emotion. It is not a feeling. It is not a blind subconscious urge towards something vaguely supernatural. It is not a conviction that one is somehow saved or justified. It is not something entirely interior and subjective with no reference to any external motive. It is not soul force, something that bubbles up out of the recesses of our soul. But faith is, first of all, intellectual assent. It is, I'm stepping away from Merton, intellectual assent. It is knowing the rules, knowing the reality of who God is and how he relates himself to us, and saying yes. It, back to Merton, it puts faith, puts the intellect in the possession of truth, which reason itself cannot grasp. It leaves the intellect suspended in obscurity without a light proper to its own knowing. Yet it does not frustrate the intellect or deny it or destroy it. It pacifies the intellect with a conviction which it knows it cannot quite rationally accept, except under the guidance of love. And here this is important. For the act of faith is an act of the intellect to consent to knowing God by loving him and accepting his statements about himself on his own terms. By faith, one not only assents to the propositions revealed by God, one not only attains to the truth in a way that the intelligence and reason alone cannot do, but one assents to God himself. One receives God. One says yes, not merely to a statement about God, but to the invisible, infinite God himself. Faith is not simply knowing the rules. Faith is having love transform your life in a way that commits you wholeheartedly to saying yes to God. Do the rules get in the way? Does truth, that is, theological statements that define what we believe, get in the way? Even our commitment to justice or our commitment to evangelism, can that get in the way? The rules that Moses gave in the wilderness are a necessary part of the creation of a Christian community. And we, as individual followers of God, can only be a part of that community by saying yes in faith to God. And it is a God who is not the God of our personal preferences or imagination, but the God who reveals himself in Scripture. Yet, without love at the center of that relationship, we would have a faith that has no power. Thank you.